1-1 pitch, swing and a drive. Deep to right field, way up there, way out of here. Goodbye, baseball.
Eight strikeouts for the King tonight and make it 23 consecutive scoreless innings for Felix.
Strike three called on the outside corner, and there it is.
It's time for the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast.
Kyle Seager, that just happened. Thank you very much.
Now, here's your host, Gary Hill.
And it's time once again for the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast. Thanks for being back. We've got a full podcast for you once again. They always seem to be full. It seems like I start that way every time. But then it wouldn't be nearly as exciting if I said we don't have very much on the podcast for you today. I mean, that wouldn't be a strong beginning to the podcast. So we do have a lot in this one to get to. The draft continued yesterday, and we're going to hear from Tom McNamara about the picks made by the Mariners. They made 8 selections yesterday, including a local product that I'm very excited about, Braden Bishop. Mariners taking him in the 3rd round. We'll hear from Braden Bishop coming up. And we're also going to hear from his head coach, Lindsey Meggs, the head coach of the University of Washington Huskies. That's going to be excellent. That's coming up as well. Josh Kearns is back for another feature, kind of off the field feature. This one's outstanding. It's on trainer Rick Griffin, and boy, it's really good. Josh Kearns, his features have been outstanding all year long. This one is outstanding as well. So that comes up in a few minutes. Of course, the game last night, the Mariners got a big win against a very good starter. We're going to dive into that one as well. Yan Gomes, who hit a couple of home runs in the game yesterday, the Mariners won nonetheless, but he's a very interesting story, and it involves Pele. Aaron Goldsmith talked with Yan Gomes. We're going to hear from that. We're going to hear from Yan Gomes. It's very interesting. Well worth it, I think. And also Rick Riz with Mark Lowe, who I think is one of the best stories of this season. Mark Lowe, who had really struggled the last couple years with injuries, staying on a major league roster, and this year he has flourished back with the Mariners. We've talked to him already a few times this season and how much it means to him to be back with the Mariners, and he is certainly pitching well, and he's been a big factor for the M's. He's moved into a setup role, a very prominent role. He's been outstanding. So Rick Riz, a chance to talk to Mark Lowe about what it's like being a relief pitcher. That's good stuff, and that's on its way. But speaking of good stuff, last night, lots of good stuff. As the Mariners facing Corey Kluber, as the gauntlet continued, the Mariners have faced a lot of good starters as of late. This is the second time they've had to face Archer and Kluber back-to-back, but good sign early on in this ball game as they made Corey Kluber work, first of all, which was good to see. But they break through in the very first inning. Morrison, the leadoff man, once again, he singled. Jackson grounded into a fielder's choice, so Jackson remained at first base as Morrison was out. But then Robinson Cano coming through with a big knock in the first inning.
And the pitch to Cano, swinging a drive deep into the gap in left center field. This one is going and going and off the base of the wall. Jackson rounding third, heading home. Up with the ball is Brantley. The throwing cut off, the relay to the plate. Not in time. Jackson scores. Standing up. A double by Robinson Cano to the base of the tall wall in left center field, right in between Rayburn and Brantley. And the Mariners have a 1-0 lead here in the first.
Great to see. We've talked about it so much, too, that the Mariners, they need Robinson Cano to be Robinson Cano. And there he was, doubling off of one of the best the American League has to offer. The Mariners with a run in the first, and they weren't done. Brad Miller, a single in the second. He would swipe second base, which was good to see. The Mariners, it has been a tough go on the base pass. They were net zero before the ball game yesterday in terms of stolen bases, but Miller swipes second, and then Logan Morrison knocks him home.
The 2-2 to Morrison, swinging a line drive, fair ball down the left field line into the corner. Miller running third, he's going to score. Morrison to second, up with the ball, now bobbling the ball down the left field line. Ryan Rayburn, the throw will go into third. Logan Morrison with a double down the left field line, scoring Brad Miller on the heels of that stolen base, and the Mariners now have a 2-0 lead.
Gomes would hit a home run in the bottom of the frame, so it's a 2-1 ball game. Roenis Elias just once again just cooking right along and got some help from his defense, including Robinson Cano.
Here's the pitch, swung on, ground ball, Cano to his right behind the bag, backhands, wheels, throws to first, and it's in time to get a hustling Urshela. Fine play by Robbie Cano. By the time he got rid of it, his momentum takes him out toward left center field. Outstanding play by Robbie Cano to get Urshela two outs for the Indians.
Mariners with some good D in this one. Rinus Elias just turned in another beauty. Six innings, five hits, one run, two walks, and three strikeouts for the Mariners starter. And he handed it over to the bullpen to try and hold this narrow lead with the Mariners in the eighth inning. And this was big, playing a little add-on, looking for a little insurance. And this is what developed in the eighth inning for the M's. They had Dustin Ackley walk to lead things off. Kyle Seager would double, so runners on second and third, and then Seth Smith coming through with a big hit.
Here's the pitch of the way, swing and a line drive base into the right field. Here comes Ackley to score from third. Over to third goes Seager. The throw to the plate is cut off by the first baseman Santana. Seth Smith hit a missile into right field, and the Mariners now lead the Indians by a score of 3-1. Seth Smith, his 15th RBI this year.
And in the bottom of the eighth inning, more defense. This time, Kyle Seager.
The 2-2 on the way. Swing and a ground ball wide of third. Diving, sliding, stop. Seager got it. Pops up. Toss across in time to rob Nick Swisher of a hit. What a play by Kyle Seager. And that will retire the side. How about that?
How about that? That was a great play. So, going to the ninth with the extra lead. It's 3-1, so a two-run cushion going to the ninth. And once again, Carson Smith is called upon. He gives up a solo home run to start the ninth. Gomes, his second blast of the ball game. This one, 413 feet. The previous was 414 feet, so he mashes a couple. Gomes is an excellent hitter. Don't get fooled by the numbers. He's missed a lot of time with injury this year, but he was outstanding last year, had a great year, and he's starting to get things rolling now. That's really going to help Cleveland as they try and make a move on the division leaders. So the margin for error vanishes with that home run, but Carson Smith still able to get it done and close out his second save.
The stretch and the 0-2. Swing and a ground ball right side. Cano is there. The throw to first in time to get Kipnis. Ball game is over, and the Mariners win it tonight 3-2 over the Indians here in Cleveland. Rowenis Elias with his third win of the year, and how about Carson Smith? His second save opportunity, and he picks up his second major league save.
Yeah, Furbush did the job in the setup role. One clean inning. Nuno pitched a third of an inning, gave up a hit, got an out. Will Helmsen, two-thirds of an inning. And Elias again, just one earned run in six innings of strong work. Two hits apiece for Smith, Seager, and Cano. And those were two doubles for Robinson Cano, which is important. Remember, he was off to a great start in terms of doubles. He had 12 seemingly in the blink of an eye, but it had been nearly a month since he's hit a double. And he comes through with two of them in this ballgame. Morrison with two hits as well at the top of the lineup. He drove in a run. Kluber ends up going seven, gives up seven hits, two earned runs, three walks, four strikeouts. Could have been more. Mariners had some other opportunities, but they made him work. He only pitched seven through 112 pitches. They got him out of the ballgame, and they got one run on the bullpen in the eighth inning. And they get a win in game one of this series. And, boy, that's big time that the Mariners got this victory in game one and a chance to take this series on the road by taking the pivotal game one. Of course, not all good news for the Mariners last night.
Now the 2-2 offer, swing and a ground ball foul on the third base side. And the count is still even at two balls and two strikes.
And the conversation coming up here, Rob Nodine trotting out.
That's not a good sign when the manager comes out with the trainer in tow, and looks like they're going to take Cruz out of this ball game. Nelson took that big swing, and Cruz is going to have to leave the game. That is a bad sight for the Mariners.
Yeah, so Nelson Cruz leaves the game. Dustin Ackley replaces him. As it turns out, back spasms, and he's day-to-day. So at that point, he leaves the game, and you're just holding your breath at that point. But back spasms, day-to-day. So it could have been worse there, and we'll get an update on Cruz today as the Mariners take on Cleveland in Game 2 of the series. They look for the series again. They face another good one, though. Trevor Bauer going to go for Cleveland. He's been excellent, 5-2, 2.94 ERA. He's one of the strikeout leaders in Major League Baseball in the American League right now. Taijuan Walker going to go for the M's. I am very anxious for this outing. He has pitched 8 innings in each of his last 2 starts. He dominated Cleveland his last time out, His last time out was against the Yankees. Gave up 3 earned runs in 8 innings. He was very good that day, struck out 7. But last time out against Cleveland, a Mariners 2-1 win. He goes 8, gives up 2 hits, no runs, no walks, and 8 strikeouts. He is best start of his career. He was absolutely sensational. I'm anxious to see how he follows that up in his 2 excellent starts as the Mariners go for the series. Now, this is a good time to mention there'll be no podcast tomorrow because it's an early game. It's a 9 a.m. start for the Mariners. So this happens from time to time with the podcast. We take the morning game off, especially when it starts early. It's a 9:10 first pitch tomorrow. So no podcast tomorrow, just Mariners baseball tomorrow. So breakfast with the M's as J-Hap, Sean Markham will go at it as the Mariners hope. Well, they're hoping that they're going for a sweep in that ball game. We'll see. So Mariners off to a good start, taking the first one from the Cleveland Indians. Now, right now, speaking of the Cleveland Indians, Mark Lowe pitched for the Indians last year. He's been around after the first time pitching with the Mariners. Here is Rick Riz with Mark Lowe and what has been an excellent story. He's been great out of the bullpen. Here he is.
Chance to visit with Mariners reliever Mark Lowe, back with the ball club after coming up with the club originally some years ago. Mark, number one, it's great to have you back. What makes a good reliever like yourself and your other teammates down there in that bullpen?
I think a specific mentality slash character has a lot to do with it. I think it's guys that if you give us like a dare or something to do on the fly, most of us will probably do it, you know, if it's something we're capable of doing and we won't get in trouble for it. It's 100% it's a mentality. It's just one of those guys that goes out and gives it 100% everything you have for 1 inning, 2 innings, whatever you're asked upon.
So that helps you to go in any type of situation, the 7th, 8th, or 9th inning, if it need be, knowing that, hey, you're in control of this thing.
100%. You know, there's times where you might have to come in, face one guy. There's times where you have to, you know, be the bridge from the starter to the back end of the bullpen. So having an open mind and just doing whatever is asked of you.
At one point, every reliever was a starter. You start off being a starter, and then you kind of work your way into that role. Somebody says, you know, I think you'd be better at this type of position than a starter. When did that happen for you?
So I started 1 year in the minor leagues, 2005. I was a starter the full season. Came into 2006, and they told me that you're just going to be a reliever. In my mind, that was one of the best days of my life because I always wanted to just be a guy that came in and blew it out for 1 inning and threw as hard as you can and light up the radar gun and punch out 3 guys and your day's over. As a starter, you know, you really, it takes you until you get to the 6th or 7th inning to kind of feel the energy in the game that you feel right away out of the bullpen. You come right in the game and it's ready, it's set up on the table for you. The energy's created, there's guys on base. And you can feel it on the field, and I kind of fell in love with that feeling.
I think you answered my next question, but a starter has a routine because he knows when he's going to start. A reliever doesn't know exactly when he's going to be in, but you know you have a chance of being there maybe 2, 3, sometimes 4 times a week. Mentally, physically, how do you prepare your mind for that and your arm for that?
Stay consistent. Every single day from about the 4th inning on, it's the same routine mentally, physically, stretching. What inning I go to the restroom, I mean, it's down to the T because you have to be so routine oriented that every day it's the same thing. There are days where maybe you get in the game earlier than normal or later than normal, but for the most part you're doing everything the exact same so that you're the exact same prepared every single day.
Visiting with Mariners reliever Mark Lowe here on Rick's Tips. And, Mark, as a starter, you have at least 3, sometimes 4 pitches. Some guys have even more than that. But as a reliever, you pretty much boil it down to 2 pitches. Tell me about that.
So I it goes back to, you know, a conversation I had with Mel Stottlemyre back in the day, and I used to be a guy that went out of the windup and the stretch, you know, and he told me, you are going to be a guy for the rest of your career that always pitches in relief. You're never going to start again. So why don't you get really, really good at pitching out of the stretch instead of just okay out of the stretch and just okay out of the windup? Like, perfect one of those.
Yeah.
And that's where you're going to make most of your pitches, is out of the stretch as a bullpen guy. For me, it was the same thing with my pitches. It was my fastball and my slider, my two best. How often do I actually get to use my changeup? Is it worth working on that third pitch over and over and over if it's just average anyway?
Right.
Let's perfect the fastball. Let's perfect the slider and make those really, really good. And that was kind of the whole idea.
Age-old question. When you were young, when you were a kid, when did you start throwing a curveball?
Probably too young. I would say 11, 12. It was a fun pitch to throw. I mean, you know, my friends threw it, and I saw the swings. I was like, man, I want to make a guy look like that. But I had a good one. It was always a slider, though. It was never a curveball. I thought it was a curveball, but to this day, I still can't throw a curveball with the right spin for whatever reason. If it's a good thing or not, I don't know, but I haven't really had major ligament issues with my elbow. I had that one thing with my bone, but everything's been fine.
Talking about fun, final question. That's it for a kid. Just go out there, whether you're a starter or a reliever, go out there and have a good time and enjoy the game.
100%. At the end of the day, that's what this game's all about, even at this level. No matter the situation, even the worst days that you have here, they're still fun. I mean, you're living your dream, and you're playing a game, and games are meant to be played and have a good time.
I'll tell you what, you're having a good time. Thanks a lot for the visit here on Rick's Tips.
All right, thanks, Rick.
And now we'll get off to Josh Kearns, who has been outstanding all year long with his profiles. This one on longtime Mariners trainer Rick Griffin.
Remember that old TV series, The $6 Million Man?
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him.
Longtime Mariners head trainer Rick Griffin is just like that guy, except he's got far more than just one $6 million man.
Basically, our main focus and our main job is to prevent injuries and then to build programs for the pitchers and the players that allow them to stay healthy.
Sometimes that's a lot easier said than done, especially when you've got a guy like Mariners Hall of Famer Jay Buhner constantly knocking on your door. After all the times he knocked into walls. Griffin even still has an anatomical chart on the wall in the training room detailing all of Buhner's injuries.
I think there was 89 of them, if I remember, 87 or 89. So there was a few. This far exceeds any other player that's ever been here, by far. But he always played. He always played.
If it wasn't for Rick Griffin, I would probably venture to say 90% of the guys that throw a uniform on and go out every day wouldn't be going out every day. So I know he kept my butt out on the field many a times and performed miracles.
Griffin's been performing his miracles since taking over as the head trainer over 30 years ago.
Just rub on Bengay to bring sore, aching muscles. Quick, soothing, radiant action relief.
A lot has changed since the days of Bengay and Ace bandages. Now, the training staff gets together every month just to go over all the advances in sports medicine.
One of the biggest changes is just the diagnostic ability of the injuries and the advent of, you know, MRI. So you can see so much more now, and you know what the actual injuries are, whereas before you guess, or you didn't really know.
And that's nothing compared to some of the far-out science that's helping dramatically speed recovery and could help reduce injuries in the future.
One of the things that a lot of people may hear about are plasma injections, PRPs, are injections that decrease the healing time of certain types of soft tissue injuries, where you take a person's own blood and you spin it down and then you re-inject it, and the platelets in the person's blood actually heal things quicker. So that's a huge thing that's been going on, more and more things like that. They're talking about stem cell injections.
And Jackson busting it down the line now. He comes up limping. Rick Griffin, the head athletic trainer. Lloyd McClendon going out to see him.
Despite all that science, though, Griffin's experience and intuition are often enough to give him a good idea of what's going on with a guy.
You know, when Jackson sprained his ankle running down to first base and hit the bag, that was ugly. I mean, I saw that. You knew immediately that's a bad injury. And When things happen, like with Paxton, you have a sense of what it is, because I've seen pretty much everything that can happen, I think.
But Buhner says sometimes Griffin's greatest help isn't what he does, it's what he says.
When I was young and reckless and abandoned, he would grab me aside and say, hey, look, dude, I'm tired of seeing you in here. I'm tired of you leaving body parts out on the field. He goes, we got to figure out a way to basically know when to say when. All right, there's going to be times in the game where you need to go hard, and there's other times in the game that you need to maybe just be a little bit smarter.
Every player is different, though, and the relationships Griffin develops with each one is key to keeping them both healthy and motivated.
He's really good at knowing every person before game time, what their game time routine is, and making sure that they get themselves ready and get their ankles taped, or one guy might be. There's a million different things, and he's got it all down to a fine art.
Sometimes, though, try as he might, and with all that science and experience behind him, Griffin can't prevent guys from getting injuries, especially the really dumb ones.
I saw a player one time strike out, walk over with his bat, and hit a rubber garbage can, and he hit it so hard that the bat rebounded back up and hit him in the forehead. And almost knocked him out, and he ended up getting, I think, about 9 or 10 stitches.
We're all dying to know who that was, but discretion is a big part of Rick's relationship with all his players.
I better not say. He's still a friend.
And 33 years later, Rick says he plans on sticking around as long as possible to make even more friends, even if that $6 million man becomes a $60 million man.
There's a lot of challenges involved, but it's still fun to, you know, when a guy gets hurt, to build a program to get the guy better and then watch him go out and play and then succeed. That still is a extremely rewarding thing to be a part of.
Stronger. Faster.
I'm Josh Kearns.
So the draft continued yesterday. The Mariners making 8 selections yesterday. We'll talk a little bit about a few of them. We talked yesterday, of course, about their first 2 picks that both came in the second round. And Brayden Bishop was the first selection yesterday for the Huskies in the 3rd round. University of Washington center fielder Brayden Bishop. 3rd round, 94th pick overall. And a pick that I'm pretty excited about. Some of you probably know, many of you probably don't, but I've been calling Husky baseball and Pac-12, Pac-10 baseball for a long, long time now. So I get a chance. It's been fun over the years too. I don't think people realize how much talent, how much major league talent was produced by the Pac-12, and you see it year in and year out. The best of the best roll into Husky ballpark before they head out to their professional careers, and many of them end up in the big leagues. It's remarkable. You just take a position like second base, for example. Just that position alone. And you look at some of the Pac-12 players that have starred just the last few years. I mean, your Dustin Pedroia's, your Ian Kinsler's, your Jason Kipnis, Chase Utley, Sogard, Bloomquist. I mean, the list goes on and on and on in terms of just that one position. There is so much Pac-12 talent going into the professional baseball and going into Major League Baseball. It's been fun to watch through the years. And Brayden Bishop is one that I've been able to watch up close. I've seen him play a lot, and he's an exciting draft pick to me for a number of reasons. One, he's a center fielder that can really fly. He is fast. He covers a ton of ground. He's outstanding defensively. He plays hard. He plays with grit. He's pretty fierce on the field as well. And he continues to take strides offensively. He's got a good approach at the plate and had a really good season. He had an excellent 3-year career as a University of Washington Husky. And, of course, leading them to the postseason last year had been a long, long time. But good, good pick by the Mariners. I'm very optimistic about what he can be. And part of it is I've seen him play so much, and I think the world of him. He can fly, too. He's really good at swiping bases, has a good knack for it, but a good player. I'm anxious to see how it develops. Here was Tom McNamara talking about the selection of Brayden Bishop.
Selected Brayden Bishop with our first pick today, 94 overall, 3rd round, University of Washington. Northern Cal kid. He was a high school football wideout, and, you know, we've been tracking him for the last 3 years. One of the better athletes in the draft. Real, real fast runner. Good center fielder, good arm. What we liked about him is we looked at him as almost like a junior college kid. He's got a young, live body, and there's more to come. He's going to fill out. It's more of a projection here. We saw him play in the Cape, and we're excited to have him. But just a quick short story. In the fall, University of Washington had the scout day. And, of course, it started raining, and we had to move the scout day from the field into the field house over at UW. And there was a bunch of stuff going on, and we ran Braden in the 60-yard dash. I think he ran a 6.37. And I know the basketball coach was there. He walked by me, and he asked me, hey, what did Bishop do the 60? And he can fly. And it's hard to find center fielders that can really run and go get the ball. Premium position player, defense, run, speed. You know, we think he's got the makeup and the work ethic to improve with the bat. And we saw a steady improvement from Cape Cod to this spring.
So that's the Mariners' view on Bishop. And I had a chance to catch up with his head coach at the University of Washington, Lindsey Meggs. Of course, Bishop spending 3 years as a Husky. And talked to Meggs about, you know, Bishop and his contributions, and also what kind of a strange day it is for head baseball coaches in college because of the dance they have to do. They wave goodbye to some players going to professional baseball. They hope their incoming players actually show up and don't go to professional baseball. It's a pretty interesting day. Exciting, interesting, a nerve-wracking kind of day for a college baseball coach. And also, while we were talking, asked him about the Mariners draft pick, their second pick overall in the second round, the Oregon State ace, who he has faced a number of times. So here it is, Lindsey Meggs. Well, Coach, a big day obviously for Braden, a big day for you, and a big day for the University of Washington Husky program. What has Braden meant to your program the last 3 years?
You know, Braden came in here as a freshman and solidified that center field position for us and that leadoff spot. And really for us, he's held down, you know, those two roles as well as anybody could. And, you know, in my opinion, was the best center fielder, not only in the Pac-12, but on the West Coast this entire year. And for us, he set the example for all of our young guys. And I think for our program in general, you know, he set an example of work ethic and just the right attitude and somebody who maximized his tools. This is a guy that came in pretty athletic and pretty well known and could have probably coasted a little bit here and there and still been in the role he wanted to be in. But from the day he got here, he wanted to be a big leaguer. He wanted to be a high draft pick. That's why he went to college. That's why he didn't sign out of high school. And he's earned everything he's gotten. And I think his family and he are thrilled to be, you know, in the position he is now at the Seattle Mariners.
Well, it has been fun to watch him fly around in center field over the past few years. How do you describe him defensively? How good is he?
You know, he's just electric from gap to gap, and the arm is a plus-plus arm, and he'll go over the fence and catch balls. He'll bring balls back into the ballpark, and really the way we looked at it is, you know, there aren't a lot of guys on your club that can change the course of the game defensively, but he can do that. He can impact the game. And not just impact it, but he can win a game for you on defense.
And speaking of impacting games, he's a threat every time he reaches first base. Teams just couldn't do much with him swiping second base.
Yeah, he's a guy that at the pro level, he's going to get so many more opportunities to run. Mm. And, you know, that's part of his game that's still evolving. And, you know, I think he can be a 30 to 40 stolen base type guy in the big leagues when he gets to that point in his career, because he's going to be that much smarter on the bases and that much more experienced. And, you know, for us, we were in so many close games, and it's tough to run when you're in one-run games all the time. He's going to have some more freedom in the minor leagues to really develop that part of his game. And by the time he gets to the big league level, he's going to be a legitimate base threat, base stealing threat.
And you mentioned evolving. How have you seen his offensive game evolve the last couple of years in particular?
You know, the challenge for us with him was you know, he was really potentially a hybrid type of hitter who could be at the top of your order, get on base, and, you know, create some run scoring opportunities, or you could put him in the three hole and he can drive the ball occasionally out of the ballpark. So for us, we used him in a few different types of roles, but I think, you know, at the big league level, some of the horses he'd have around him in terms of more physical guys, you know, he's going to be an outstanding top of the order doubles type of hitter who you're going to get some surprising power from before it's all over. Sometimes that tool, as you know, kind of kicks in late, but he's going to be a real good table setter at the top of the order with some juice before it's all over.
Well, it's been a big couple of years for your program. All kinds of guys drafted last year, set a school record. More guys getting drafted today. What does this say about the state of your program right now, sending so many guys to the next level?
You know, I think it's obviously a compliment to my assistant coaches and the commitment we have to player development. I mean, you know, this place has a lot to offer kids academically, socially, and we've proven that we can get to the postseason, and the College World Series is a goal of ours every year, but as much of a goal as the College World Series is the commitment we have to our guys to get them into professional baseball. If you play in this league every day and you put up the numbers that a Braden Bishop put up, I mean, you should have a chance to not only play professional baseball, but have a chance to play in the big leagues. And when you're lucky enough to be chosen by that local team, you know, the Seattle Mariners, I mean, that's a dream come true for anybody who plays at the University of Washington.
Boy, it's kind of a unique situation, too. There's not many universities that are basically right next door to a big league team. What has that relationship been like between the Washington baseball program and the Seattle Mariners?
You know, it's really evolved over the last 6 years, and I've had a few conversations with Jack Cirincic that I've really enjoyed and really appreciated in terms of him taking the time to drop me a line now and then to congratulate us on some of the things that have happened. And, you know, Tommy McNamara is as solid a guy as there is in terms of trying to respect what we're trying to do and yet accomplish, you know, the goals that he has for the Mariner organization in terms of finding the best players that are amateurs and building that draft year after year. But he's been really respectful of our program and our guys, and I appreciate his input, and I think he appreciates mine. So on that level, we couldn't ask to be treated any better. You hear a lot of clubs across the country who don't have that kind of relationship with some of the local pro teams in their area, and that makes it frustrating, but they treat us great. We respect the heck out of them, and we're grateful for the relationship.
What is this day like for you? You guys are getting drafted, which is exciting. You'll lose some of them to the pros, obviously. Maybe some will come back. And then you're looking at replacing those guys. In your shoes, what is today like?
You know, it's a exciting day for all of us. And at the same time, it's really nerve-wracking because we want the guys that are here to get their opportunity and to do it as juniors, because they'll get rewarded financially if they can do it. Mm. At the same time, we have a whole list that we have 17 kids scheduled to come in at a high school and junior college in the fall, and you're holding your breath, you know, that those guys are going to make it here because some of those guys will be drafted too. So we're watching both ends. We're trying to help guys get out the door, and we're trying to keep guys coming in the front door. So it's a double-edged sword, so to speak.
And lastly, the ace from the Oregon State staff, Moore, what have you seen from him this year?
You know, Andrew's a great competitor. He was a guy that literally you knew when he went out there, if you didn't get him early, you were going to have very little chance of being successful, because once he settled in and was able to throw those secondary pitches for strikes along with that 92-mile-an-hour fastball, which he could throw, you know, create that tilt and throw straight down into the bottom of the strike zone. I mean, you were just going to have a tough day. And the thing that I liked the most about him was you'd watch him throw, and the Seattle fans will love this, and you'd never know if he was up by 10 or down by two, because that is one cool customer on the mound. He doesn't get rattled. He can succeed in virtually any role, and I think you guys have a great one there. You're going to be really pleased about him.
Well, Coach, I know this is a busy day for you, a busy time of year for you. We certainly appreciate the time, and it's been fun watching you build the program there firsthand and see all the success you've had the last couple of years. It feels like it continues to build and build and grow and grow. So congratulations to you and the staff and Husky Baseball.
Thanks, Gary, and congratulations to you guys, and good luck with the rest of the draft.
Well, it was a busy day for the head dog, and I certainly appreciate him taking the time to talk about Braden Bishop and what was a big day for the Huskies. They also had their catcher, Austin Rye, drafted just about the same time as Bishop. They had known each other forever. They've been childhood friends. They ended up at Washington together, and they get drafted nearly the same exact time as Rye. Is a real good one. He's a catcher going into the Red Sox organization. So congratulations to Husky Baseball, Rye, Bishop, and Mariners as well for taking Bishop. Now, speaking of Bishop, and you may have seen the off-the-field stories too, which I haven't touched on yet. Go to Seattle Times. They've written some really good pieces on Bishop and his mom. And Bishop yesterday talked about that a little bit and also talked about him as a defender and a hitter.
You've got a reputation as a very good defensive player. How's the offensive game come along? And is that a big thing for you to work on going into pro ball here?
Yeah, I mean, I have heard a lot, and, you know, through the draft process, it's been made pretty public that, you know, I have a weak bat, but, you know, I've never believed that, and I think, you know, I bought into my role here at UW, and that called for me to get on base any way I could. So, you know, I had to sacrifice, you know, power numbers to be a top-of-the-order guy and get on base for guys like Robert Pell last year, Trevor Mitsui, Brian Wolf, so they could drive me in. And then this year, I had a different role, and, you know, I had hit 14 doubles, I hit 4 home runs, a triple. So it's not that I can't do it, but it was the fact that I was buying into the role to help my team win and be successful. So, you know, it is a stereotype that was put on me. But, you know, I strongly believe that I'm a good hitter, and I'm not going to stop working at it. You know, I don't have it figured out, but I have a lot to learn, and I'm excited to work with the coaches and the Mariners organization to take my bat to the next level. You know, I'm willing and I'm eager to do that.
Ben, a lot was made about your push to help promote the Alzheimer's awareness and things with your mom. How important is that to you, and can you talk a little bit about that, you know, going forward here?
It's very important to me. I mean, my mom's my biggest advocate, so I'm going to be hers, and it's tough to see her struggle, but it definitely puts things in perspective for me. You know, if I struggle, I know she's going through it a lot worse than I am. So, you know, for me to be there for her and to bring this whole situation to light has been really important for me. It's definitely kept me going and, you know, provides motivation for me every day. But like I said, it's hard to see her struggle, so any difference I can make to fight this and to show her that it's not going to win is very important to me going forward.
So there it is, Braden Bishop. I'm excited to see his career get going. So we'll touch on a couple of the other selections for the M's yesterday. After Bishop in the fourth round, they took Dylan Thompson, a right-handed pitcher. He's out of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Again, here's Tom McNamara on Thompson.
Dylan Thompson, our fourth round pick, 125 overall, was a high school pitcher from Socastee High School in Myrtle Beach. Pretty high-profile guy. We've seen him all spring. We had him come out to Seattle for a private workout as well. We wanted to meet and greet, get to know him a little, and came out through a bullpen. It was sometimes it's good to get to know the high school kids a little more than you already do. He's loose. He's projectable. He's got a good delivery. We think he's a starter, and that's important. We wanted to... If we were going to take pitching this year, we wanted to take pitchers that were starters or starting potential pitchers. And the delivery, the arm action, the command, the velocity—it's a lot of good raw material he hit to work with.
And this pick, I have no firsthand experience with, so I have nothing to follow that up except to say that one of my followers and contributor from time to time, Zach Gonzalez, who checks in, and I'm glad he did this time around for sure, at ZGonzo3, pointed out that he lives in the Carolinas. So he said, I watched the M's fourth-round pick, Dylan Thompson, pitch live this spring in Myrtle Beach. Athletic frame, low 90s fastball, nice breaking ball. Pretty good scouting report right there, and not a bad scouting report from a high school pitcher. So it's pretty interesting. The Mariners took a few young high school right-handed pitchers, and we'll see how he develops. Now, their next pitch, I feel like, boy, part of this, you know, I watch Pac-12 baseball all the time. I love college baseball. I think it's just a hidden gem. And I feel like they were right in my wheelhouse with some of these selections, with Moore, the Oregon State ace, with Bishop out of Washington. And then their next pick, a shortstop out of Stanford named Drew Jackson.
We took Drew Jackson, shortstop out of Stanford University. We've seen him since high school. He's had some bumps and bruises here and there with some injuries, but he came on strong down the stretch this year. And his brother was a first-round pick out of Cal Berkeley, and we've seen him since high school. He was up at our pre-draft workout as well. He's a physical shortstop that can really run, and we think we're getting him at the peak of his season. We saw him late. We've known about him for years, and we just kind of sat and saw him up in Eugene, saw him up at our workout, and his game was coming on towards the end, right before the finish line, and we were excited to select him.
Pretty interesting pick, I think. So Jackson, his brother Brett Jackson, you may have heard of, who went to Cal, was a pretty high prospect with the Chicago Cubs. Got to the majors as a 23-year-old in 2012, but you know, struggled at the plate. He broke in again in 2014 with Arizona, but has never quite been able to get over the top. Now, Drew Jackson, the Stanford shortstop, a guy who he'd struggled with the bat his first couple years at Stanford, but really came on with the bat this year and had a nice season. But I think what impresses the most about Jackson, first of all, his throwing arm is pretty ridiculous. He's got a cannon at shortstop. I mean, he could play in short left field and he could throw guys out. It is stunning sometimes, the throws. There, you can see it, too. He's on YouTube. Actually, go to the Stanford page. I think it's up. If you go to the Stanford baseball website, and it's right there in his player profile, just click on that video link, and you see some of the throws that he makes. He can really play the position. I like that pick a lot. I mean, you love guys up the middle defensively, which I like Bishop. I like Jackson as well. And you know, he was really on the upswing offensively this season, too, which is a good sign. Jackson was drafted in the 37th round by San Francisco in 2012. In 2013, he hit .207 with the Cardinal, .167 last year, but he's busted through, batted .320 this year in 40 games, started 39, missed some time along the way, but has really come on and playing well. And again, defensively, outstanding defensive shortstop. So there it is. Hopefully the Mariners will pick some more Pac-12 players today so I can give you more of my thoughts on Pac-12 players. Because that's about, in terms of high school players throughout the around the country, I can offer nothing because I haven't seen them, but I can just give you what I read and what I hear. But, yeah, it's fun to have some firsthand knowledge of this. I'm always amazed the whole draft process when you consider, I mean, consider how many schools that you have to look at from every high school. Just think about where you live and how many high schools there are just around your area. And then just expand that out to the country. You have to cover every high school, every community college, every college, I mean, whether big or small. I mean, you look at just who the Mariners have drafted so far in this draft. I mean, a high school pitcher out of Georgia, and you have a pitcher at a major Division I college university. A couple others like that as well, but then a high school pitcher out of South Carolina, a player out of a Division II school. I mean, a high school pitcher from Indiana. I mean, it's just, they're everywhere. They go everywhere. LSU, Arizona State, major universities as well. It's quite a process. It takes a ton of organization, a ton of time, and those scouts doing a lot of legwork. That is no joke how much work they put into what they do. So The day continues today. The draft continues today. And we'll have more on that coming up on the podcast, not tomorrow, in 2 days. Now, we're going to end things with Yan Gomes, and because I think the story is outstanding. I love unique stories like this, unique stories about a guy who got to the big leagues from where you wouldn't expect. So here's Aaron Goldsmith with Yan Gomes.
Yan, you have carved out already a terrific career for yourself in a short time in the big leagues, and you are one of only a handful of Brazilian-born players in Major League Baseball. What was it like for you playing baseball in Brazil growing up?
Well, at the time, I didn't know much about the sport, so what we had, the resource that we had, I thought it was great. You know, we had, I guess, what here is like Little League fields that we played. But at the time, I enjoyed it, and, you know, it's where I grew up. It's where the foundation came, so I'm still grateful.
You played your college ball in Knoxville, Tennessee for the Volunteers. What was your transition like from Brazil to the United States?
Well, I moved here when I was 12, so I got to live up a little bit of the American life a little bit. Went to high school here. Then when I went to Tennessee, it was definitely something different. You know, Miami is still almost like being in another country. You know, there's so much adversity there. But it was amazing. I still live there. I met my wife there, and I call it home.
You grew up speaking Portuguese. When you came to the United States, did you speak much English?
No, I didn't speak anything, man. I didn't know, and I hated it. I didn't know how to get around or how to communicate, so I had to stick to a very tight-knit group of my family.
And your English now is flawless, but when you were coming over to the States, what was that like for you transitioning into a school system and trying to learn a new language, which, as you said, you didn't speak at all?
Well, it was tough. I mean, I can tell you that when I was in, because I moved here, I was in fifth grade, and I mean, I must have ran away from school several times because I just didn't want to be around it. It was kind of but at the time I thought it was a waste of time because I didn't know what was being said at all. So, but I mean, I learned it quick because I, you know, growing up, sports was a big thing, and once I started playing baseball, I started meeting a lot of guys and guys that I'm still friends with, so it definitely helped me out with my English.
Sports is how you learned English, in other words?
Pretty much, yeah, pretty much.
So we know that in Brazil, soccer rules all, and Pelé is the ultimate king of Brazil. And the All-Star break back in 2013, you were home in Miami, and you received two tweets from Pelé, whose Twitter handle, by the way, is very simple. It's @Pelé. And one was in English, and one was in Portuguese, and it was incredibly heartfelt. Can you tell us what that was like?
I mean, it's almost like, you know, once my parents and, you know, my dad grew up watching Pelé play, once I told them that I got a tweet from him, it was pretty amazing, man. I mean, there's so many things I could compare it to, but, you know, just hearing my dad and how excited he was, and I mean, I was super pumped because like you said, that's like the major one of the major idols that you grow up watching, you know. But when he tweeted me and just told me, you know, how proud and how everything was going with me, it was pretty amazing.
You said at the time it was like for someone in the United States if Babe Ruth tweeted you.
I guess yes, that's pretty much comparable. Yes.
See you later.